This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Americans tend to work a lot. That work ethic has contributed mightily to the nation's success. Even during the recession, the U.S. was able to remain at the top of the list of the world's most productive countries. Much of the credit for that goes again to the fact that we work a lot. This time, it was fewer people shouldering more responsibility that allowed us to remain productive in the face of layoffs. But all of this takes a toll. Europeans, for instance, look at us and just scratch their heads. They get more vacation time than we do, and they take it, while many of us don't take what little we have. Your grandmother used to say that all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy, and she was right, but perhaps Jack was dull because he was burned out. There's a lot of that going around, and companies are beginning to notice and see it for the problem that it is. Some corporations are now looking for ways to improve conditions for employees to keep them on the job and energized. They're helping employees to achieve a work-life balance. But how? Well, that's what we're going to find out this hour. We're joined by Dr. John Bennett, Associate Professor of Business and Behavioral Science and Director of the MS in Executive Coaching and Organizational Development Programs at the McCall School of Business at Queen's University, which is presenting a work-life forum on the campus tomorrow, I believe. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Frank Brooks is also with us. He's president and CEO for Freeman White, Inc., which works with clients in the healthcare environment. But his proudest achievement, he says, is the role he played in shaping his company's culture, something we'll talk about in the course of producing a work-life environment. Thank you for being here.
I'm glad to be here.
And Sharon Reed recently served as Senior Manager for Strategic Market Initiatives at Lime Energy and partners with the City of Charlotte and other organizations as a consultant to promote best practices in clean energy. Thank you for being here, too.
Appreciate the opportunity.
When did companies first, and I don't know who to ask this question, but when did companies first start becoming concerned about an employee's need for a work-life balance, particularly in the face of a lack of unions pushing for things like this?
Well, I think it's, from my own personal experience, I would say it's been driven both from an employer perspective and an employee perspective. I know my own experience with WorkFlex dates back 15, 16, 17 years when I began my career at KPMG. There wasn't actually a formal policy in place at that time, but I was looking to make a shift from public economic development to the private sector. I actually wanted more balance in my life. You know, I wasn't a parent at the time. I didn't have elder care issues. I just wanted balance in my life.
And a lot of young people, particularly young people out of college, want that, it seems to me. They think nothing of taking time off because they want to go play. Is that a new phenomenon? Is that what we're talking about, or is it more than
maybe
that?
I'm truly of the current generation and not my own. But, my mindset back then was that there's got to be a way to have both. And maybe we can't have everything at the same time, but we certainly have tough choices to make as employers and employees.
Is a 40-hour work week too much?
No. This is coming from a CEO and president.
That's right.
Of course not. Working 40 hours... We don't really think of it that way. We have goals and accomplishments that we want to achieve. And so what does it take to get there? How do we accomplish that? We work in teams, and the teams sort of self-direct and take care of business. So thinking of 40 hours versus 30 hours versus 50 hours is not something I don't think many of our people think about.
People work more than 40 hours for the most part?
I can speak to the leadership of our company. I think the answer is yes. But where they're working, and because it's so – there's a lot of travel. There is electronic connections. There's so many connectivity opportunities that we're working a lot of times when we're not in the office.
Right. The reason I ask is because this work-life balance discussion is relatively new, I think, in the scheme of things. And I'm just wondering where it's coming from. I mean, is it because people – I know it's people are burning out. Are they burning out because of the fact that they're working more than 40 hours and because they can't disconnect even when they're on vacation because they've got their iPhone and they've got their iPad and they've got their laptop and they can't get off the work?
The technology certainly makes us a 24/7 environment, work environment. And you add to that two other factors that come up for me. One is we're in a global society. So the clock doesn't stop at 8 o'clock Eastern Time, p.m., or start at 7 a.m. or something like that. Businesses are operating 24/7 around the world, mm-hmm. more so than we did a number of years ago. A piece that you mentioned about maybe generational difference, certainly what we know is that the younger employees are saying, I don't want to have the work life that my parents had. I want to have more balance. And so they're demanding that for employers.
And is that because they didn't see it pay off?
Didn't see it pay off, perhaps. They also are seeing that there is a different way of living mm-hmm. That's possible. And so why do I need to fall into the trap that so many others have fallen into? I can manage that a little bit better.
That's all. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. I'd like to jump in and say, too, in my entire career, other than a brief time when I had children and was working a true part-time schedule, I've never worked a 40-hour week in my career. I have always given more than I've received in benefits. And when we talk about work-life balance and even some of the initiatives like WorkFlex, some specific tools and strategies, you know, I think it's a two-way street. I don't think it's just an entitlement issue, you know, from an employee perspective. Oh, I want this balance. I want to do less. I think it's a matter of output and market demands as well and what the employer needs.
I would echo that, too. In the architectural profession, design profession, there are daunting deadlines. Mm-hmm. We're chasing a project. We have to go after it full bore. Well, there's a trade-off. You're asking people to give a lot during those times and to reciprocate, to be the kind of company we want to be. We want to make sure that we're attentive to their needs, too, when the time comes. And so it is it's a value-for-value exchange. And it's an unwritten contract, but it's built into your culture, and that's how we deliver our work to clients at a very high level.
So when the project is underway and you've got deadlines to meet, you expect, and it is expected of you and you as an employee, understand that you're going to put in a lot of time. But when there's not a deadline looming, it's a little more relaxed.
That's true. But even if there's a deadline, if something comes up, we're working in a team. The team adapts to help that person mm-hmm. and realizes that they are a whole person. And if I can speak just a minute on the whole person idea, in a design profession where creativity is paramount, we're looking for whole people, not people that are just workaholics, because as you design healthcare, you need to have people that are empathetic, that have a family life, that have social responsibilities and are integrated into the society. So we want people that are whole people so they can relate to our clients on multiple levels, not just kind of technical, architectural, design wonky kind of levels. Mm-hmm. It's about the whole person, and that's the kind of services we're providing for our clients.
Tomorrow, Queen's University is sponsoring this Work-Life Forum, which invites participants to, and I quote here, learn about best practices and solutions for your organization to more fully energize employees by promoting their physical, emotional, and social well-being, gain employer of choice advantages needed to attract, engage, and retain top talent. That sounds almost pre-recessionary in its focus when people just left jobs because there was another better job waiting around the corner, and now there's a lot of unemployment, particularly in North Carolina, where we have not recovered as well as the rest of the country. And given that high rate of unemployment, why are more enlightened companies bothering to focus on this when they can get anybody? There's a billion people out there wanting jobs. Go ahead.
Well, I'm going to say, in at least the case of certain companies, it's a market-driven issue. It's also a bottom-line issue, and we've pulled several examples. If you look at SaaS, carry-based SaaS, IT company, in an industry where turnover is 30% on average, they have less than 3%. They have a very, very progressive culture when it comes to work-life integration and balance. And as a consequence, that translates into savings of $67 million a year for them in reduced turnover costs that take the form of recruiting, rehiring, retraining. Aetna would be another example of a company that extended their work-life benefits for paternity and maternity leave for their employees, saving $1 million annually in retention. Another company, we're going to hear from KPMG tomorrow, and their approach is a little bit different on this issue. One of the things that's been driving their policy from a top-down perspective has been market issues and the demand for diversity in leadership. And when you have a demand for diversity in leadership. And in this case, I'm speaking from the female perspective, there are demands on working mothers and perhaps working single mothers that may be different for men in the workplace. And so they've had a need to come up with some policies that really help promote women into leadership and give them the flexibility they need in response to market demands from their clients who are asking for diversity in leadership.
When you talk about attracting key and retaining key talent, good top talent, are you talking about just the ranks of upper management, or are you talking about the rank and file employee?
Go for it.
Well, I can address this. We're talking top to bottom. And in creating and maintaining a culture, there may be a lot of people out there, but you want the right people that fit your organization. And that takes some work, and it takes some clarity about purpose and who you are as a company and your stated values. I found something, this is just an interesting aside, that when we started intentionally thinking about corporate culture, we made a list of our values. And I had it on a board, and I was talking to the office about it periodically. And I happened to have it sitting in my office when I was interviewing a potential recruit. Mm-hmm. They saw that, and it just lit them up. And so it articulated values, if they're the right ones, will really excite some people. And what starts to happen is there's a self-selection that occurs, that people that are really excited by that or attracted to your company. So you start reinforcing the cultural values that you are aspiring to, probably. You probably have a lot of them, but you're also aspiring to certain other ones.
If I understand this correctly, Dr. Bennett, at Queens, this started a couple of years ago as a conversation about how to address employee burnout and caregiver issues, because a lot of people today are caring not only for their children, but they're caring for their parents or they're caring for sick spouses or whatever. And it's now grown into what you describe as a formal platform on a wide variety of work-life topics. Mm. What exactly does work-life mean?
Well, I always think of that with a hyphen in it, not an or, because we often think about, okay, because we often think about work or life, and I'm either doing one or the other. And as Frank has mentioned and Sharon have mentioned, these examples where companies are realizing that you bring yourself to the workplace. I remember years ago working with a consulting client that had a consultant come in earlier and said, when you come to work, wipe your feet at the door and leave all of your personal issues behind. Now, I don't think that's possible. We bring ourselves to work, and a good employer is going to want that employee to bring all of who they are. That also means not only bringing the good stuff, but probably some baggage. The child care issue that they left behind, or the spouse that's ill, or the grandparent, or whoever it might be, those pressures are there. And so when we go home, we don't wipe our feet and say, I left my work at work. That mindset is still there. We are still a whole person no matter where we go. And so as we think about the challenge of attracting and retaining and engaging high talent, it's not about high unemployment. It's about having the right people in the right job, in the right organization, at the right time. And so we have people turning over because it's not the fit anymore. Mm-hmm. We have employers saying, I want to find the right employee, as Frank has mentioned. It's attracting that talent. So when we think about work-life balance, it's the combination of work and life and how those come together. So I think that brings the topic to bear as we think about such a demanding workplace and a workforce and in society that's changing rapidly.
Well, I want to come back to Frank Brooks's comment about searching for the whole person, because as you just mentioned, Dr. Bennett, the whole person, when he comes to the front door of the office every morning, if he's bringing all of his baggage along, do we really want all of that baggage to come in the front door? We have to take a break, though. We'll come back with that in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
This is Charlotte Talks here on 90.7 WFAE, listener-supported public radio. This is an encore presentation. Support comes from WFA members and Blumenthal Performing Arts presenting singer-songwriter Steve Earle and the Dukes performing the poetic spirit and cinematic energy of his music September 12th at McGlowan Theater. Tickets available at 704-372-1000. and the Echo Foundation celebrating 17 years with its award ceremony and gala reception honoring Ben Bernanke and Tom Ross, Thursday, September 17th at McGlowan Theater. Tickets at echofoundation.org. And Alta Vista Wealth Management, providing personal investment strategies, financial planning, and advice. Ned Zorgin has more information at 866-684-2600 or altavistawealth.com.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, across the country, many schools have struggled to find qualified instructors in areas like science and math. California had more than 20,000 slots to fill this academic year. A holiday rebroadcast, what's behind a nationwide teacher shortage and how states are trying to address it.
Join us for the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 until noon on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the work-life balance, something that some companies, more enlightened companies, I suppose, are trying to emphasize for their employees. We're joined here by Dr. John Bennett, Associate Professor of Business and Behavioral Science at the McCall School of Business. Frank Brooks is President and CEO of Freeman White. Sharon Reed is a management consultant. They're all part of an event on this topic tomorrow at Queen's University. We'll have more information about that on our website at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. Let me get back to this bringing the whole person. I know you're looking for a whole person. Well, you just said that, Frank Brooks, when you're looking for an employee, because everybody is a whole person. They do have interests outside of work, but I'm an old person. And we were told, and particularly in broadcasting, where everything is fairly compartmentalized. I mean, you have to be pretty focused. So if you're having a bad day at home or you ran over a squirrel on the way in and that disturbed you, you leave that at the door because that has nothing to do with this. Why do you want that coming in the front door?
Well, the answer on the whole person is I don't think you get to pick. The whole person's walking in the door. They are who they are.
Why aren't they expected to leave their baggage, their negative baggage at the door?
I think they are to some degree. I think it comes down to professionalism. You have a job to do. You have teammates to support and an overarching goal for our clients to achieve. And that takes precedent at work. It doesn't mean you leave the rest behind.
Mm-hmm.
It is there, certainly in the background, and it may have side conversations and things that go on. If I can speak about the outside experiences, you know, there was a question asked us, where do great ideas come from? And the answer is it comes from differences. It's getting people of different backgrounds, the diversity issue, bringing people together with different professional views and getting them together. And that includes the whole person and the experience that they've brought to the table. And in a creative endeavor, that's essential and very important. So, yeah, there can be some negative aspects, and I think that some of that is self-controlling within any culture, that people say, hey, enough of that. We've heard about you running over the squirrel long enough.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we need to move past that. We have this beautiful building we're designing, so let's get on with that. So I think some of that kind of naturally happens in the flow of the cultural development.
But it seems to be very difficult when you have people coming in who you've developed a culture that allows for personal issues to be handled from time to time. If you have a daycare issue or a child gets sick at school and you have to go pick them up, or you have an elder parent who missed a doctor's appointment and you've got to take them today, and you're allowing that to happen in the workplace, how does that affect the organization?
I want to jump in here and speak to the power of team. And, you know, everyone's heard the acronym, Together Everyone Achieves More. And I was once known for saying it, under unhealthy circumstances in an unhealthy culture, it stands for territorialism eventually annihilates motivation. And I think, you know, Frank has spoken to the issue here today already. I think it's a case of operating as a team and team being a fundamental part of the culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in the global world we operate, you know, certainly in my own past experience where we're collaborating across the globe on a 24/7 basis, the ability to collaborate and truly act as a cohesive team and step in and be a pinch hitter for your teammates when needed is essential.
You've said, Frank, that one of your proudest moments of all the things that you've done in your work life is to build this company culture. What was your approach to doing it?
Well, I was fortunate as I was coming up through the profession. I had several great mentors. And it was sort of a work hard, play hard approach to the business. Mm-hmm. We would work our tails off and accomplish great things, and we'd go have a lot of fun. I kind of picked that up just intuitively. But it wasn't until the early 90s I came across a company from California, a mutual client introduced us, and it was an organizational development company. Well, I didn't know what that was back in the early 90s. I go, oh, you deal with these issues? There's corporate culture, and there's a whole kind of science behind that? Yeah, so I learned a little bit about it. And then I went, well, gee, we need to take what we're doing, even though we had already had some of those values developing, but they weren't consistent or throughout the organization. It might have been in pockets. So how can we take that and then make that more of a fully integrated set of values across the company? It started with, actually, I wrote a white paper in the early 90s because I came back talking about corporate culture. My partner said, what are you talking about? And I explained it, you know, the values, attitudes, and beliefs that shape behavior in organizations. And I'm sure John can give me a better definition than that. But I wrote a white paper and kind of took the blinders off and said, here's the good things about who we are, and here's some things that aren't so good. And what can we do to address that? And we started with an articulated set of values that I've spoken about earlier, mm-hmm. and then started to talk about it. And we would talk about it some more. We would ask people their opinion. We would started to be very inclusive about our challenges and goals for the company. So it started just sort of that way with a intentional plan based upon a lot of intuitive feelings about what it ought to be.
Is it safe to say, Dr. Bennett, that every company, whether they know it or not, has a culture? And so if you're going to have a culture, you might as well sit down and try to figure out, define it and articulate it and write it down and then follow through? Is that what you would suggest?
Well, I would say it's less important to have it written down than to actually be intentional about creating it. The writing down is certainly a good exercise and articulates it and allows you to communicate it in one fashion. More important about a culture is that what you say is the culture is what you actually do as the culture. And it's the difference between espousing a set of values and beliefs and actually living them. And when we think about culture, cultures are hard to change. And it takes generally 3 to 5 years before we begin to see a change in an organization's
culture. Is that
because
it requires a turnover in personnel to inculcate them into the new way of doing things because people are stuck in the mud?
Yeah, not necessarily turnover, but a change in mindset, mm-hmm. and a change in beliefs and a change in behavior even more so. Because the what we see on the surface of an organization's culture, those kind of artifacts of what are our policies, how do we treat other people, what kind of attitude do we have about work and life and the balance between those, all are the kinds of things that are on the surface. What's hard to change is the underlying assumptions and beliefs. And what do we really believe? Why do we want this policy in place? Mm-hmm. And so when an organization, as Frank is describing, can be intentional about that and think about it and say, here's what we need in order to do the work that we're doing for the clients that we're serving.
I want to come back to something that Sharon Reed said a few minutes ago. And you were talking about companies making allowances for the demands placed on single mothers, for instance. But there are a lot of single parents, single fathers, single mothers. There's two working family households, so that both of them have more responsibilities for at home and at work than they used to have in the 50s and 60s. But then again, there are people with no responsibilities outside of work. There are young single people who, when they get off of work, they hit Bar Charlotte, and that's their life outside of work. Is it fair to them? How do you make it fair to those whose tugs and pulls are much less than a single mom, for instance? You give the single mom a lot of slack to take care of the problems that she needs to take care of. As a single person with no responsibilities, what do I get?
Well, I'm glad you brought up the fairness issue. That's one of the things we're going to tackle tomorrow on the panel discussion at the forum and kick it out there. I think it's difficult. It certainly is a gray space issue, and these issues are not unique to women. I've been in dialogue with Virgin Media in the UK over the last couple of months on this issue, and their issues are not only centered around how do you accommodate women, how do you accommodate single fathers, as you point out, you know, as well as, you know, the whole workforce that might have other needs and demands. And I think the fairness issue is a valid point. I think it comes back to culture. I think when you join an organization and you understand what that culture is that you're joining and what the expectations are, this is a team environment, we're going to pinch hit for one another, that helps mitigate that issue, but certainly it's out there. Frank, do you want to address the fairness issue?
Well, I think it is that gray area, like you said so well. But I was reflecting as you were talking that there's some, overarching things about delivery of what you're supposed to do at work, either for the client or internally. And those don't change regardless of all your outside pulls that you may have. You still have to perform. So ultimately, you have to perform. And for someone that may not have all those family responsibilities, they probably have other interests, and I know they do have other interests, at least people in our office do, and there may come times where they want to do some of that. If they've already delivered and supported their team and worked hard, you have cut a little more slack with that and make sure they have that ability to fulfill their lives in other areas.
But this
too
sounds very subjective. It's not like punching a clock. The clock was a very dictatorial and also objective way to deal with things. You're talking about being very subjective here.
Yeah, Mike, I'm going to jump in here, and let's talk about Best Buy for a minute. Best Buy is one of the feature companies in a book I edited earlier this year called What's Your Green Goldfish, and it's on best practices in employee engagement and workforce culture. And in 2005, they embarked upon a pretty radical experiment called results-only work environment. And they decided that they wanted to do away with the idea of measuring people's productivity by how much time they sat at their desk. And said, listen, okay, on our corporate headquarters, you can come and go as you please. You can come in at 2 o'clock. You can leave at 2 o'clock. We don't care whether you're a single mother or you're just a young 20-something who's going to hit the bars, as you said. What we care about are the results and what are you getting done. And they've had tremendous success with the program. And there were a couple of folks a couple of years later from the University of Minnesota who did a study to see, what were the results of this experiment. It's a pretty radical approach. Come to a meeting if you feel like or not. Placing full accountability for the output on the employee. What they found was productivity and job satisfaction both increased over 30% from the time they started the study until.
Well, that's the management team. What do you do to make it fair for the people on the sales floor who can't come and go when they just choose, because otherwise there'd be nobody on the sales floor? What do you do for them? What kind of slack do you cut for them at Best Buy?
Well, don't you think there's an expectation if you're coming in that role? I think there are certain roles in certain companies and industries that lend themselves to these policies better than others. And I think, to be fair, there are some that don't lend themselves.
So what lends – well, I was going to ask you this, Frank, because obviously you work in a creative environment and there are a lot of creative companies who want people – you look at Google. You walk into Google, I'm told. I have not been there, but you walk in there and they're playing ping pong and some people are sacked down on the couch at 2 o'clock in the morning because they're still at work because they love their jobs and they want to be there and be part of it, but there's no structure. It's just kind of very loosey-goosey. That works for them. And obviously you want creative people to have time to think and brainstorm ideas, but then there are jobs like having to be on the sales floor or be in a factory making the widget. You got to be there. You got to be there from 9 to 5. You got to be engaged while you're there or the machine will crush your hand. I mean, and you can't leave the production line because if you do, there's a hole in it. So what kind of companies does this lend itself to?
Well, I can speak for our company. Mm-hmm. And, of course, there is value in the whole team being together at certain times if they're working on a project. So there are times everybody does need to be there. We also have clients that are working 8 to 5 or in a hospital environment, maybe longer than that, that are calling the office and needing responses. So we have to be able to respond to that. Now, smartphones, et cetera, have allowed us to stretch that some, so we're always available. But there is some, at least in our business, there's a core time to be there. If you pull out every once in a while for some personal need, that's okay. But if it starts becoming a regular thing, then we have to talk and see how we can structure that a little better. So, again, it's not a rules-driven organization. It's more principle-driven. It's more goal-driven. And I think if you start with that premise, you can build a flexible structure that can adapt to particular needs of individuals as it goes through. So it's not a hard and fast answer, and I don't have a hard and fast answer for that, Mike.
Well, I think this points out how we've evolved as an economy. The day of working on the farm, you got up in the morning, and when the sun rose or before the sun rose, because things had to be done, and you had a growing season, you worked hard during that growing season, you worked during the winter in a different kind of schedule, but you worked because that was the environment, that was the work that needed to be done. We then moved to an industrial environment, industrial economy, and that's the assembly line. That required us to work in a different way. We're moving more and more towards an information economy. And as such, our workplace is changing. The workforce is changing as well. So we've gone from that kind of mechanistic environment of the workplace to one that has much more of a sense of the people. Mm-hmm. And I often ask the question, how much of your operating expense is people? And in service industries, that's usually 80 or 90% sometimes. Even on the average, I always end up with somewhere around 50 to 60%. So if you think about it, that's the largest single line item expense in a company's budget, operating expense. What are we doing to make sure we manage that effectively? And that's what we're really talking about, is that investment in human capital.
And it's not just giving time off or being flexible about work hours when you're talking about this work-life approach to running a company. It's also about a company making allowances for the things outside work that impact their employees through things like, as we said, flexible work arrangements, enhanced leave benefits, employees support programs like having as resources child care, elder care, financial and estate planning, health and wellness information programs, and more. This sounds way outside the realm of traditional benefits package that have been historically provided. How does a company afford all this?
How can they afford not to? Again, if you look at the statistics out there, and it's great that companies are actually starting to measure their programs, because I think the only way that you can create that widespread adoption is when you can measure impact. But certainly there are a number of cases, and again, SAS is a really powerful example right here in North Carolina of a company that is saving $67 million a year by offering all of these various benefits in order to avoid burnout, avoid turnover, and all the costs associated with that to an employer.
Well, Red Ventures is a company here in the Charlotte area that gets a lot of notoriety and has this kind of high productivity, high production kind of mode as a part of what they do. Yet they're able to offer, for example, a basketball court on their property for the employees. I think they're rebuilding, as somebody told me the other day, they're building a new building and it has a wine bar in it for their employees. And so these are the kinds of things that, whether we want to know it, admit it or not, our workplaces are becoming somewhat like a country club, because that's the way that we need to engage the employee to make them differentiate as an employer.
Sharon.
And I'm going to jump in and say this is not just a domestic issue. It's not just a Charlotte, North Carolina issue or even a United States issue. You know, I had the great privilege of being in China a couple of times during the past couple of years. And one of the most memorable moments for me, I mean, the Chinese have a reputation for working just tremendously hard and for, you know, long hours under difficult conditions. And I remember a team of us were visiting a cement plant and they asked us to stay for the end of the day because this was their annual basketball tournament against the Chinese central government. And their employees were led, the captain of their team was Chairman Wu, playing the Chinese central government. So again, this is not just a domestic issue, but it is one that builds camaraderie, it builds commitment, a sense of loyalty to companies.
Did the company lose against the central government? One hopes that they were smart enough to lose. Yeah. We have to stop, take a break, and come back with more of our conversation in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
And this is an encore presentation of Charlotte Talks here on 90.7 WFAE, your source for in-depth news. And support this morning comes from WFA members in Womble Carlisle, whose attorneys provide business solutions to middle market executives at companies that drive the economy. More information at gettoknowwomble.com. And Bojangles, featuring the smoked sausage biscuit, hickory smoked sausage on a made-from-scratch buttermilk biscuit, available all day at area Bojangles. on Diane Rehm. Coming up at 10 o'clock, across the country, many schools have struggled to find qualified instructors in areas like science and math. California had more than 20,000 slots to fill this academic year. A holiday rebroadcast, what's behind nationwide teacher shortage and how states are trying to address it. That's coming up on Diane Rehm at 10 o'clock. Mike McNamara of Greer Walker in Charlotte, a WFAE underwriter.
We still get people who say, oh, I heard you on WFAE. You guys are bigger than I thought you were. We're part of the community. WFAE is part of the community. So it makes total sense to us that we would be part of the WFAE family. WFAE makes it easy. It's effective. We can't think of anything we'd rather do.
For more information, email underwriting at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. John Bennett is with us from the McCall School of Business. Frank Brooks, President and CEO of Freeman White. Sharon Reed is a management consultant. They're all here in advance of a seminar tomorrow at Queen's University about the topic we're talking about now, finding work-life balance from both a corporate point of view and, I guess, the employee's point of view, because it has to work both ways. Let me bring a caller into this conversation. Tom in York, South Carolina. Welcome.
Good morning. I'd like to ask the folks how their philosophy meshes with the Jack Welch GE philosophy of the bottom 10% of employees are let go every year. And if you're rated in the bottom 10%, you're gone. And that promotes an unhealthy work environment.
Okay, let's get an answer to the question.
Yeah, so I think I'm confused about your sense of what an unhealthy work environment is that's fostered by performance management and competition for high achievement.
Okay, I'll tell you. I work for a very large insurance company, and they were not shy about discussing the lifeboat philosophy, where if your rating doesn't put you in the lifeboat, you're going to be let go. Mm-hmm. We can get your job done in India for 20 cents on the dollar. I worked in IT for many, many years with artificial short target dates. Crisis management was the way we worked. Could change the priority in an instant. And that's what I'm talking about. And we had flexible hours, and generally the company wasn't a bad company, but it was very large and multi-site, and these kind of things may not work. They may work in a smaller company, but of course a large company.
Address that.
Yeah. So one piece to always think about is that there are a variety of companies with different cultures that make them appealing to different employees. So I always say, if the sandbox is not one you want to play in, then go find another sandbox. And the GE culture is one that has served GE quite well. Some people thrive in that environment. The high performance, the measurement of, we're going to take the bottom 10% of the employee performance out every year. We're going to expect you to continue to grow and develop and set higher and higher standards. That's the culture of that organization. That may not work for every employee. While that may not be perceived by me as being the environment I want to be in, that's not going to create the kind of work-life balance that I would want to have personally.
But his question does bring up something kind of interesting that we haven't talked about, I don't think, that there is a sense of responsibility on the other side. I mean, you can work for a company like yours, Frank Brooks, and have these perks, or you can work for Red Ventures and have a basketball court out front and a wine bar if you want to take advantage of it while you're at work, but you also have to perform. And that, it seems to me, requires a certain kind of disciplined personality, somebody who can litmus test themselves on a regular basis.
And I'm going to jump in there and say a lot of the pyramid-type companies that he's referring to, you know, big management consulting, no exception, they're designed, you know, they're created by design. And they attract highly driven, motivated employees that are willing to perform above and beyond.
Mm-hmm. But then if you're performing above and beyond, how are you achieving a work-life balance? Suddenly you're giving your life to your work.
Well, again, I found this great quote the other day that said, there's no such thing as work-life balance. Everything worth fighting for unbalances your life. And I think when we talk about this issue, we have to talk about work-life balance in terms of work-life integration. And I think what strategy works for one person, maybe the answer for them is part-time or a reduced schedule or a compressed week. For another person, it may be the ability to work from home, even though they may work 30% more hours because they're in IT and supporting e-commerce, working a 24/7 schedule.
Now you're making it sound like it's impossible to manage.
I don't think it's impossible to manage. It does require, you know, no pun intended, a degree of flexibility from both the management and the employees.
Well, I think the balance just doesn't occur like on a weekly basis. It's over a longer period of time. There may be periods where you really do have to put in those hours to achieve what you want to achieve. But you need to look at it as you're looking at your life as a whole. There are certain times in your life you can probably do more of that. Other times you can't. So it's some personal judgment about when to put the effort forth, the extreme effort forth, because you're always putting a great effort forth. So,
I mean, I think the women's movement said you can have everything. Is that really true? Whether you're a woman or a man, whether you're black, you're white, you're pink, can you have everything?
Well, I'm going to speak from the woman's perspective here today on the radio. I certainly am one who have, you know, always strived to have it all. And what life has taught me at this stage of my life is that I can have many things and I can perhaps over the course of a lifetime have it all. Trying to have it all at the same time and perform at an A level in all those areas of your life is difficult to achieve.
What impact has this had on the bottom line of your company being flexible about this? And how do you know what that impact has been? How do you know you wouldn't be making more money today if you were less flexible?
Well, that's probably impossible to answer, but I can tell you some of the things that we've looked at. And I go back to when we first started this intentional cultural movement within our company. Since that time, over the next 10 years, we probably increased our top-line revenues by probably 10%. Ten times.
Maybe it'd be 20 times if you had people coming to work more often.
Possibly, but then the question about is it the culture, is it the market, is it we had some good salespeople, we did great designs, it's hard to separate all that out. But I do know that alignment of purpose and attracting the right kind of people had something to do with that. Mm-hmm. And so a 10 times growth in revenue over a fairly short period is pretty impressive. Was culture the main driver? I couldn't tell you, but I think it had something to do with it.
You all say, I believe, that among the benefits of creating a work-life approach in the workplace include increasing employee engagement, enabling better talent attraction and retention, strengthening team dynamics, improving productivity, lowering stress-related health costs, reducing absenteeism, despite what we've been talking about, flexibility here, and increasing loyalty. I think all of these things have come up at some point in this conversation. Is there empirical evidence that these things happen in a workplace that you're talking about creating?
Well, those are all different measures. Mm-hmm. What we know is that employee engagement, the way of getting employees to not only feel satisfied in the work but being productive in the work that they're doing, is a hot, top priority for many, many companies. And there are three key ingredients in that process. One of them is that the employee recognize and have a clear sense of purpose. So why am I here?
Mm-hmm.
A second is that that employee have the resources that they're able to use to get that work done. So when you take away the ability for that employee to be effective because they don't have the tools, the resources, the relationships, the connections, technology, whatever it is. And the third is that that employee have the opportunity to grow and develop. Those three ingredients, those three legs in the stool, create employee engagement. If you take those away, any one of those, the employee engagement will drop. There are many other factors, of course, that are involved. Now, all of that is done in the context of an organization, and part of that is the culture. How does the culture show up? It shows up in the behaviors of that company. One of those behaviors can be, do we appreciate the employee for who they are? For what the issues are that they have, do we create the kind of environment that allows that employee to thrive, mm-hmm. to have their personal needs met along with their work needs.
Prior to the late 20th century, there was a lot of worker loyalty. People went to work right out of high school or college for a company and stayed there until they got the gold watch at 65. And the company took care of them from their point of view with vacations, and they took care of them with pensions and health care. And that seemed to go out the window a lot in the late 20th century with a shift toward no pensions, you're on your own with your IRA or your 401k, and other things that changed in the workplace. And people don't feel loyal to a company, and young people particularly think nothing of working someplace for 6 months and moving on because they got a $10 raise someplace. Right.
Or they have the opportunity to build their resume for right. the next opportunity.
Right. So loyalty is a two-way street. How do you reestablish that? Is it an outmoded concept? Can you really be loyal to an entity and not a person?
That's a great question. I think yes, you can have loyalty to. If you're talking about an integrated culture, there's loyalty to that set of beliefs and behaviors, and pride in what you're part of as a company. You can have immense loyalty to that. I know I feel that toward our company. Mm-hmm. Being president and CEO, maybe that's a different perspective, but I do feel that loyalty, and I think a lot of our people do. Now, the idea of treating people fairly, people understand that it's a dynamic economy, and things are beyond our control, and you go through a recession like we've been through. Mm-hmm. I mean, there have been hard decisions and things we've had to do, but the way we handled it was with respect, with transparency, with an explanation so people understand why we had to do certain things, and then making every effort to, if somebody ended up being laid off, making every effort to help them on the next step in their journey. So there's loyalty to our values, and the people went away feeling good about our company, even through some really difficult times.
Let me take another call. DW in Mooresville, welcome to the program.
Thanks for taking my call. I have a little bit of an issue with the previous caller and with one of your commentators that tended to imply, especially the commentator, that you can't be a high-performing, high-excelling employee that can excel in a GE-type environment, but also be able to create an effective work-life balance. And I think that you can. I've done that. And I think it's partly upon the employer to find those kind of individuals in the hiring process who are willing to say that I have a responsibility both to my family and to my employer. And having responsibility to one doesn't relieve you of the responsibility to the other. You just find a way to make it work. Now, sometimes in my life that meant I had to give up sleep, but you made those two things work. And I'd just like to hear comments about that.
Sure.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm going to jump in and say that, as Frank and John have both suggested, it's a two-way street. And as much as employees are looking for that values alignment in an employer and vice versa, from an employee perspective, it begins with knowing yourself. It begins with understanding what your priorities are, where you're willing to set those boundaries. In fact, we're going to talk about boundaries tomorrow at the forum. And sometimes that involves taking a risk and having an honest conversation with that employer. But I would tell you that if you're clear on who you are and what your values are, and you're willing to take that risk and have that honest conversation, if it's not a good fit personally, I'd rather know from the outset. But I certainly agree that you can do both, but I think there's a personal responsibility there to make that happen.
Frank? I think that's very insightful, and that point of having a conversation with your employer to say, I have family responsibilities, I have to go to a recital at 4 o'clock tomorrow afternoon, but I will finish my work, and I will work late the next day if I have to make it up. Those are both the responsibilities of the employee and the employer to understand and be willing to accept that. That's a great comment.
Thank you
for taking my call.
You're welcome. Thank you for your call. Matt, welcome.
Hey, Mike, thank you. I think your panelists are right. You either get the culture you want or you get the culture you deserve. So organizations have to be focused on that. To me, it's interesting that you haven't used the C word, careers. I used to be, I'm 55, and when I started at a college with a company, everybody was talking about furthering your career. Today, as the middle class seems to have gone away, companies are scrambling to try to figure out how to put careers back in their organization. So maybe your panelists could talk a little bit about the importance of companies focusing on careers, because careers have changed.
Okay.
Well, I can address it from our particular company, an architecture and consulting company, that we have a lot, our young people come in, they're focused on becoming architects or whatever their engineer, whatever their chosen profession is. So they are looking at it as a long-term endeavor, which is a career. It's actions over a long period of time and not just a task-oriented job.
Right.
So we attend to that certainly with all of our employees and helping them achieve that goal. Now, whether they fulfill that at Freeman White, maybe not. It just depends on where the pathway takes them going forward. Can they feel that they can flourish in our particular environment? And so, yes, career is very important, and actually it was one of my notes. I wanted to make sure I made that distinction. But a career doesn't have to happen just at one company. It can be a mix of companies where you find yourself taking the next step in your fulfillment and self-actualization as a person.
Thanks for your call, Matt. We have an email from, not an email, it's a tweet from Jeffrey, says that working in the nonprofit sector, there is no work-life balance. How can you find that in a nonprofit? What can they do? Maybe no-cost ways of being flexible.
I think there's some, having worked in nonprofit environment myself in the past, I would say that a lot of people drawn to that space are drawn to the intrinsic value of the work they're doing. And with that, there are often trade-offs. There are tight budgets, limited staff. There's always limited funds, particularly in this recession. You know, in my own case, the intrinsic value of the work I was doing was sufficient to offset some of the flexibility I may have given up at that particular moment. John.
Yeah, I want to comment on that and also the career question as well. Finding ways of creatively working together to make the work environment effective for you is the conversation that I would suggest this person have. Mm-hmm. So get the group together and say, what can we do within the limitation of our time? And probably the creativity of that team can find a solution to that.
Dr. John Bennett is Associate Professor of Business and Behavioral Science at the McCall School of Business at Queen's University of Charlotte. Frank Brooks is President and CEO of Freeman White, and Sharon Reed is a management consultant. They're all part of this work-life conference tomorrow at Queen's, which is open to the public, and you can get information about it on our website, wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. Thank you all for the hour.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. Our producers are Aaron Kiever and Tim Ross. Our engineer is Joey Sprinkle. For more information about archives, upcoming shows, and podcasts, or to continue the conversation online, visit our website at wfae.org.